Welcome back to another Wednesday Action Enneagram podcast. My name is Creek, and today we are doing a typing interview. Mario got on a call with actually another one of my friends who has attended the Awareness to Action certification program, module one, and had some questions about his type. So Johnny is a great guy, and this was quite a ride. So the intention of these episodes is to kind of put an actual human, a person to that subtype, which is strategy and instinctual bias combined. To get specific examples and kind of understand what is it that Mario and Maria Jose are looking for, or what questions are they asking in order to get a particular response, and then making a preliminary hypothesis from the data that they collect. So this is actually the first session that happened back in December. And then next week we'll have another session with Mario and Johnny recently, where they kind of reviewed what happened, how it's hitting Johnny. And at that point, I had joined the typing interview and kind of contributed some of my observations as well. So make sure to listen to both, and then we'll do a little bit of an unpacking episode alongside of that. So without further ado, here you go.
I always find it's helpful to kind of define exactly what we're talking about when we're talking about Enneagram type, right? And for me, this thing we call Enneagram type is just the label that we give to people who use one of nine adaptive strategies more than they use the other eight, right? So there's nothing essential about this, right? There's nothing, you know, I don't do what I do because I'm an eight. We call me an eight because of the things that I do, right? And when I say things that I do, it's my habits of thought, it's my habits of emotion, it's my habits of behavior, right? And each of these sets of habits are rooted in a tendency to use, you know, one of these strategies more than we use the others. Okay. We know that, you know, humans are habitual creatures, right? Anything that we can automate, put onto autopilot, we do, because it just makes life easier. It frees us up to think about other things, okay? So there's nothing exclusive about any of these, right? You can find any of these types in yourself, right? Because, you know, if what I mean by that is that you can find behaviors or attitudes that we typically associate with a particular type in yourself, even if it's not the ones that you do more than you do the others, right? So if, for example, I believed that I was a five, I could find a lot of five stuff in me, right? And I could build a case in my own mind for being a five. And, you know, and the things that I identified would be legitimate for the most part, right? You know, it's like, yeah, I do that, right? But I wouldn't be seeing that I do something else more, okay? So that's all we're looking at here, right? What are the things that we tend to fall into doing more than we do the other things?
Yeah.
Okay. And this is why identifying your type can be difficult, right? Because, you know, when we're seeing other people, we're seeing what gets through the filter. Okay. And, you know, and that's kind of what the word personality means, right? It refers to a mask, you know, that they wore in ancient drama, the persona. And, you know, and so we tend to betray a type outward to other people, but inside, you know, we've got all these thoughts going on, right? We've got all these emotions, we've got all these impulses that we don't always act on in front of other people, okay? So we tend to seem a lot more complicated than other people do, right, to ourselves. So I always want to start there, right?
So that's actually really helpful just to say, because there's moments, especially early on when Enneagram was introduced to me, that I genuinely identified with all the numbers. Like, as you know, like different Enneagram coaches would go around and be like, hey, let's just talk about them all. We'll start with one, end with nine. And they start going through and I'm like, yeah. And then some more than others, but there were moments where I'm like, gosh, all of them. That was at least at the start. I was like, I can think of moments where like that was my modality. Like, that's how I was thinking about the thing. So that was really confusing to me at first, because there was a moment where I'm like, I don't know. So that's helpful. Right. It does kind of like unlock a lock that's just like, yeah, I have access to all of them.
Yeah.
It's just which one is kind of home base, or the language you just used, which one gets through the filter. Yeah. That's really helpful to hear.
Yeah. Good. So let me ask you this, Johnny, how did you get into doing what you do?
Oh boy. I'm parsing out a medium length answer. All my life, I've had lots of interests. I kind of bounce from one thing to the next. And so even post graduation, got into, gosh, I did a lot of things. I was a financial professional for 3.5 years. Then I got out of that to help my brother-in-law start a church in the northern suburbs of Detroit. Raising money, had to get a part-time job working at Apple, which I really enjoyed, and doing the church thing. My wife is from what's called Upland, Indiana, and that's where Taylor University is. And that's when I called my friend Drew Mosier, and he was working there, and asked him if he thought I'd like higher education. And he said, I think you would, but you'll need a master's. And so he was a reference for me to go back to school 7 years after my undergrad. And one thing kind of led to another. I've come to really enjoy this age group. I just see so much, it's cliche, but I see so much potential. Like that 18 to 22, there's just so much happening. And I get to come alongside of that. And then in my work, it's a myriad of stuff that I've been able to pull from my past. I have pretty like hefty and intense budgets that I have to handle, but then we do like parties and dances and concerts, and that's really fun. I mentioned the Apple thing. So like, I really like video editing and media stuff. And so like my work gets to do a ton of things, that's really fun. But I think my favorite part about it is coming alongside the students and letting them do it. Walking them through the wins and the failures, helping them discover who they are, helping them discover what they want to do. Cause I will sometimes say the language, like I understand what that's like to not understand what you want to do with your life, because I'm still trying to figure it out. And getting to like kind of come alongside that with all these various tools that I've been able to kind of accumulate over the years from various backgrounds and careers. And a few years ago finished a certification in life coaching. So I've been able to bring that kind of to the table as well and helping others. And so it was that's a really abridged version. There's a lot more gaps, a lot more things that happened. But that's kind of what brought me to literally where I geographically live, because that's where my wife wanted to live. And this is in central Indiana. And I remember thinking, what am I going to do in central Indiana? But there's these two universities pretty close to each other. They're about 20 minutes apart. And I've now worked at both of them. So we're pretty committed to the area. And these universities just kind of tee up students, literally. They just like sit right in that chair because they have to. And we get to just kind of pour into each other for the amount of time that I get. And it's really quite rewarding and challenging and frustrating. And I kind of backed into it. It kind of just happened. And I'm really grateful for it.
Where are you from originally?
Ohio. It's not too far from here. Couple hours.
Whereabouts?
Near Toledo, a small town called Archbold, Ohio, a northwest corner of Ohio. I was raised on a farm. I'm a farm kid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm curious. I just finished a year-long engagement with the Texas Farm Bureau. and which, you know, I didn't know anything about. I mean, until they had reached out to me, I didn't even know the Farm Bureau existed, right? And it just was a fascinating engagement because it introduced me to, you know, a whole element of, you know, the world that I wasn't aware of before. Okay. Although I did spend 3 summers working on a dairy farm in high school. Not foreign to it. But yeah. I find that people either, you know, when they're young, either really love farming or can't wait to get away from it. Mm-hmm. Were you in either of those categories or were you somewhere in the middle?
Yeah, fair question. I think I really respect my heritage. I never really pictured myself staying in Ohio and farming. And in some ways, I even feel guilty of that. But my dad has now stepped away from the farming as well. It's just getting really difficult to make a living. You kind of have to be a mega, like a really big farmer. And right. We were medium-sized at best. So he's pivoted and has a different career. But it was my full upbringing, though. I mean... Yeah. Like lived on the farm, did 4-H, all the things. In reflection, as I look back, and I mean this in all sincerity, like I feel like I'm a really, really hard worker. Maybe have too high expectations sometimes of others because of my upbringing, because of my chores, because of what I was like told I needed to do. But I look back and I'm actually really grateful for some of the things. Now I just have to kind of refine and edit that when it comes to like expectations for me, expectations on others. But I guess I'd rather pull that back a little bit than try to like figure out how to be a hard worker, I suppose. But that's kind of a long way of answering your question. I embrace it and I'm proud of it. I like going home over the holidays and my uncles and people still own property. So we'll drive the tractors and get to hop on the combine. And my kids like that. But yeah, I'm pretty removed from it at this point. It's just kind of part of my past now. Yeah. So
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. The farm I worked on was in upstate central Pennsylvania, right? So just 20 miles from the New York border. So, you know, I'm in Philadelphia down in the lower, you know, east corner. And, you know, this was, you know, back then it would take about 6 hours to drive there. Now you can do it in 3.5 because of the highways. But, it was hard work and it was, a small family farm, 650 acres, husband, wife, their 2 kids who were teenagers when, you know, I knew them, a couple of hired people, and I would do, you know, in the summers I would go and help out. But I remember, so I was, I guess, 15, 16, my first summer there, probably 15. And the owner of the farm was 42, I remember. And he just was like, it seemed to me to be a broken down old man, you know, because of the labors, you know, the physical nature of of the farm. And I never forget. I mean, it's hard work, and to your point, the industry is changing, right? I mean, it's hard for people like that to make a living. I was up there recently in that area, I guess last year, and the farm's long gone, you know, and most of them are up in that area. So interesting. Tell me about being a people pleaser.
Mm-hmm. In what way?
Well, in what way do you feel like you are a people pleaser? What does that look like in your life? And let me be careful about that. So there are all sorts of ways. I kind of keep it vague on purpose, but this need to feel like the people around you are happy.
Yeah. It's so potent and knee-jerk for me that it even is alarming when it surfaces, because it surfaces very quickly. I used to kind of blame it on a lot of things maybe even like sexist things where I was like, I'm just a man who just wants to fix things and fix people. I'm like, or I'm just a person who likes to help. But like, I feel compelled with, as a student opens up to me, a colleague yesterday opened up to me about some stuff going on in her life with her kids. And I was like, I think I can help. Like, I had some resources. I had a sister-in-law and brother going through something very similar. And in a matter of hours, I had them all consented and they all were texting with each other and I'm like helping. But I realized, I think there's good motives as to why I like to do that. And I think there's the motives, like I said, those shadow sides where I just really, I think that's where I find value or worth probably. Whether that grew out of even my farming roots or whatever, like your value is like what you bring to the table and how you, what you offer. And so I find many times when I'm honest with myself, I'm doing it because I'm trying to vie favor from them. Like I'm trying to, I want to be, I don't even like saying it out loud, but like, I want to be liked. I want to be accepted. We all want to belong. And that seems to be like my quickest and simplest tool on how to get there. I feel well connected here or there, or I'm resourced here, or I'm educated on this, and I can say this or do this or connect these dots, and it's going to really help out your situation. And so I'm just really compelled to fix, help, come alongside, to the point where I've had to do a lot of work on that. But
because if you are liked, then what?
Yeah. I mean, the simple answer is probably like, if you're liked, your sense of belonging seems to increase. I think it's sometimes as elementary as, well, you don't like people who aren't helpful or nice, so you might as well be helpful and nice. And a better chance of the person probably liking you. I don't think I think that often.
Sure.
It's probably more of a subconscious thought. Yeah. But I'm like, well, if you're not helpful or you're not whatever, like, why would anyone want to be around you or anything like that? I'm sure it's something there. And this derails, and then I want to come right back. But I've just been doing a lot of work and being less helpful. And maybe my help is actually just sitting with the person and not fixing it. But that's a bit of a detour of like, and that's some different philosophies and things that I've been reading about where sometimes, actually oftentimes, the person in front of you that's burying themselves isn't even looking for an answer. They think they are, but they're just looking for somebody to hear them and be with them. And so it's been a real like pullback for me when I feel the urge of helping to be like, yeah, that's natural. Like that's, it always comes up. And then I try to tame it and just sit with them. And relate to them. That's a bit of a tangent, but that's just been an area that I'm working on because I feel so compelled to help, to address, to resolve. In fact, probably in a way, my mind hack is the best way to resolve is to not resolve. It's just to actually sit with them. It's actually just to be with them. But anyways, I digress.
No, that's great. Yeah. Somebody recently put it to me. He got it from a book. I forget which book, but he said, essentially, you know, in those situations, we need to ask ourselves, does this person want to be helped, heard, or hugged? Right. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they just want to be heard. Sometimes they just want to be hugged. Sometimes they're looking for a solution. And we have to, you know, ask ourselves, but also ask them, right? You know, what are you looking for here?
Yeah. So, well, and I want to say in my work, like the umbrella of my work is student development or student affairs. And I've also realized oftentimes when a student comes in with a question, I can either give them the answer, which is helpful, or that like kind of takes the opportunity away from them for them to even learn. So I've had to completely pivot. And a lot of my students get pretty frustrated with me because I don't give answers anymore. Like I'm usually like, what do you think you should do? I'm always turning it back on them. That's taken me years to get there. Cause at first you're like, they're asking me for help. I can help. And turning that on its head to when students come in, they're like, I already know what you're going to say, but here's my question. And, or here's the issue that's happening. And I'm usually, and the, usually pushing it back on them. But again, in my mind, though, that's probably me saying that's actually the most helpful thing to do for them is to help them figure it out themselves rather than just give them the answer. So I don't fully divorce or get away from helping. I'm still helping. I'm just doing it in what I think is a better, more philosophical way. But I'm still helping. So I'm not in some sort of delusion. But
Well, it's a good point. It's funny because in the coaching world, and you know, I started doing this before there were coaching schools and the, you know, the coaching federation and all that, you know, sort of stuff. You know, what coaching schools will teach people these days is, you know, it's not up to you to solve their problems. It's to get them to think, blah, blah, blah. But I remember years ago, a client saying to me, you know, he said, you know, Mario, I've had coaches before and they would just ask me how I felt about things and blah, blah, blah. And he says, you know, sometimes I just want somebody to tell me what to do. And, you know, and, you know, the key is to understand when somebody needs what, right? Yeah. And my view is I agree with you. We want to equip them to be able to solve this problem on their own in the future. But I also want to make sure that they leave the room with an answer, you know, you know, if we
can. Yeah, it's certainly a balance because there's times, it depends on the student. Are they always the one that's looking for a quick answer? Or is there one where I'm like, I think they need to feel the grind on this one and try to figure it out. And sometimes I think I get it right. And actually, sometimes I think I get it wrong. One of my students, actually the current student body president, the other day called me out and was like, I need an answer. And I was like, yeah, like, cause I was doing it too much for this person and they actually just needed some guidance. The point is though, then I'm no longer coaching. I'm actually just an advice giver, which is fine, which is totally fine. That's actually what she needed in that moment. But a good coach can actually help mine and help them find the answer within themselves and being patient with that process. Right. And sometimes that's okay. But again, sometimes the person standing in front of you didn't consent to being in a coaching relationship. They just asked for like the advice. And so you're like, okay, here's what I would do. I don't know if it's the right answer, but here's what I would do.
Right.
Yeah, and there's room for that too.
Yeah. Gotcha. Yeah. With the three instinctual biases, preserving, navigating, and transmitting.
Yeah.
Any sense of where you fall on those three?
I should have done a refresh because man, I was in that deep when we were going through all of that and I took a lot of notes. Let's see. Subtype two, I think I put down the connected transmitting. I have in my notes here that this is probably me. Seductive, not necessarily sexual or romantic, but draws people in. They will pay attention to people. They're passionate, dramatic, mistyped as a four, like me.
Why would people mistype you as a four? What was the rationale?
I have moments, I don't think this is my big draw, but I have moments where I don't mind standing out. It's a fine line because I don't want the attention, but I want a little bit, which sounds like a four. Before you met me, I had a beard that went down to like here, a giant beard. And then when I cut it off, I still have like a long mustache. Like I do things. I have aspects of me that wants to feel unique, I think, but it still doesn't feel like home base for me. I have friends that are fours, Seth Creekmore and others that I'm like, I don't think that's not where I live. That's not home all the time. But I like expressing myself occasionally. Does that answer that question? Anyways, I don't know. Connecting, preserving. I said, I don't think this is me. Let's see. Focus on other people's needs. I'll help you, but I need you to also take care of me. I do resonate with that, but that's probably just two-ness. Connected, navigating, establish their identity to whom they are connected. Status oriented. I put this might be me, but then by the time we got to transmitting, I was like, I think that's me. The transmitting piece. I think that's what I do all the time. I'm always wanting to like, I don't know.
Tell me what you get frustrated about.
Okay, let's see. I get frustrated when I'm misunderstood. That frustrates me. What I mean by that is, like, if somebody puts me in a box too quickly because they didn't get a chance to know me and it's inaccurate. That's really what it is. When it's inaccurate, that bothers me. I'm sorry I keep bringing them up, but both the Seths in my life call me out on, I don't get frustrated very often. I think it's an emotion that I need to exercise a little bit more. I think I, probably some of my upbringing and various things were like anger and frustration are bad emotions. And so they're heavily suppressed in my life. So I don't have a great relationship with frustration or anger. I think I just push it way, way down because they're not useful emotions in my mind. I'm well aware that they are, but yeah. In fact, I think I probably look down on people that are quickly frustrated or angry. Like, get control of yourself. After a lot of work, I'm realizing that is not really how I want to approach those emotions anymore in my life. But it's a bit of a tangent. But I struggle with the emotion of frustration. But that is an area, though, that I mentioned. When people don't understand me and misunderstand me. Yeah.
All right, so at this point, Mario is about ready to give you his preliminary hypothesis, and then they'll continue talking a little bit more about why. So here's your few seconds to kind of formulate your guess, holding it loosely, of course, and we'll get back to the podcast.
I may make an assessment.
I'm here. Let's do this.
And let me caveat this in that, you know, we've been talking for 38 minutes now. And, you know, and I got some feel of you throughout the program, but, you know, it's not enough to be, you know, all that useful. And so what I like to do, Johnny, whenever I offer somebody a kind of a provisional assessment, is I ask them to think about it and then to loop back with me to debrief it. Okay. Because I take this very seriously, and I don't like to just dump something on somebody and then, you know, say, okay, have a nice life, right? Because it can be disoriented and it can be, you know, it's just irresponsible. All right. So let me start off with that. Second, and I'll ask you to forgive the apparent arrogance that comes with this statement, but most people teaching the Enneagram don't know what they're talking about, right? And one of the challenges with much of the Enneagram literature, it's especially the things that have kind of permeated the evangelical world, it's copies of copies of copies of incomplete things to begin with, right? The other thing is, you know, I am of the school of thought that all knowledge is evolving, right? That all knowledge is incomplete. And, you know, so any theory is just a work in progress, okay? And with rigor and thoughtfulness, the theory gets refined and strengthened over time. And if that's not what people are doing, then it falls into dogma and it gets stuck. And, you know, the challenge of the Enneagram is that even the mediocre teachings of it have a lot of power. Right. And we can see other people or maybe even see things about ourselves and say, oh, my gosh, that's so me, that we can kind of swallow the whole thing. Right. Without realizing that, yeah, the whole thing needs work. All right. So I'm just going to come out with what my perspective is and I'll explain why.
Okay?
So I think you're a navigating seven. All right. And let me share why. Okay. All right. Number one, the type 7 is the most misunderstood of all of the Enneagram types in the literature, right? It's, you know, they're thought of as being superficial. They're thought of as being, you know, happy all the time or, you know, irresponsible and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. You know, those things are true of some sevens. I have never met, you know, look, I live with three sevens, right, including my wife, right? So I've got kind of a master class on sevens going on. And yeah. I've worked with a lot of them over my 30 years. And what I find with sevens is that hardly ever talked about in the literature is they have this deep need for the people around them to be happy. Okay. And when it comes right down to it, it's, I can't be happy if you're not happy, right? I want to be happy. And so that makes me very attuned to other people's happiness. And I really want them to be happy, right? For the seven, feeling content, feeling stimulated, feeling the positive sides of the world are really, really important. And it's easier for me to see that when the people around me feel the same thing. Okay. There's just this thing in every seven I've ever met that has this need to make sure the people around them are taken care of in some way. Okay. That's consistent with what you're describing about yourself. Okay. What I am not perceiving from you in that I get from twos is, number one, you've done absolutely nothing to flatter me during this conversation, okay, which I appreciate, right? But with whenever I'm dealing with twos, I feel like they're throwing syrup all over me, right? And, you know, and I get none of that from you. You're a nice guy. You're a pleasant guy. You're a, you know, you seem like, you know, be a great guy to sit down and hang out with, you know, have a beer with or whatever. But I don't get this need to kind of, you know, suck me in some way. All right. Your background of, you know, a bit of this, a bit of that, a bit of that, a bit of this, right? Pure seven stuff. Okay. Now, this is not to say that, you know, everybody has a completely linear background, but you know what I hear in you is all about possibility. Okay. And even as you talked about the students, the thing that motivates you about them is that this is an age in life when people are filled with possibility, right? I mean, it's, you know, there's all these things that you can achieve in life that you can go accomplish. And for the seven, that's like heroin, man. I mean, it's like, you know, it's this, you know, wow, it is such an interesting world out there. And there are so many things that people can do that can happen. It just excites me even thinking about it, right? It gives me deep pleasure. And I'm happy to do that even vicariously through other people, right? Just, you know, there's something very satisfying in feeling the possibility of that other people are experiencing. Okay. The reason I say navigating instead of the transmitting, now I can see why you would think transmitting if you're thinking about the two, because there is something about the seven that is kind of transmitting, right? There's this, again, it's about stimulation and excitement, right? These things are fun for me, you know, the beard thing, the mustache, you know, one of the ways in which we get stimulation is to kind of stir things up a little bit, right? Get a little reaction out of people. Okay. And the conflict that you have around the transmitting stuff, you know, you said, I've got a little bit of it, but, you know, not so much. I mean, I could hear your conflict regarding that. That's what we see in navigators, right? The transmitting domain is what we call the zone of inner conflict, Okay. So there's a part of me that's pulled toward it, and there's a part of me that's repelled by it at the same time. Okay. So I move toward it, I pull back. I move toward it, I pull back. Usually navigators are very good at doing the transmitting things in their role, right? It's my job to be transmitting right now, so I'm comfortable with it, okay? When it's not my job, when it's in a social situation or, you know, something else, I'm a bit more conflicted, okay? Now, again, a navigating seven will seem a bit more transmitting because they are a bit more verbal, a bit more talkative, a bit more upbeat than people of other personality styles. Okay. But again, there's this conflict in it. Transmitters are not conflicted about being the center of attention. Okay. In fact, they can't understand why anybody would not want to be the center of attention. Right. What I find, it's intriguing to me that you, where were you at? You had a financial role. Was it a financial advisor or financial manager? Tell me a little bit more about that.
What more do you want to
know? Well, what were you doing and what drew you to it?
So in college, I was a business major. My thought was to make a lot of money. And then my Christian thought was to make a lot of money and help a lot of people. And so post graduating, I was like, well, the finances is probably a good way to do that. And it felt like it was coming alongside and helping people. And so I tried it and it was not that fulfilling. It was a good grind. I mean, I did it for 3.5 years and I was just like not feeling it. And ended up stepping away from it. But yeah, it was like my first stab at what I thought I wanted to do or the direction I thought I wanted to go.
Yeah. What I see in navigators when it comes to the preserving domain, okay, of which I would put, you know, finance, you know, I would put finance in there and other things, you know, things, having to do like even farming is kind of a preserving activity, but you know, home repair, fixing things, all that sort of stuff. There's kind of I get that it's important. You know, it's just not stimulating to me. It's not gratifying. And I understand why managing your money is important. It's just not where my energy goes, right? Mm-hmm. I know that I need to fix things around the house. It's just, I'll find a way to put it, you know, kind of to the end of the to-do list, right? You know, and you know, so again, there's this, you know, it's not love, it's not hate, it's just, I'll get to it when I have to, all right, kind of approach to things. I see you reflecting there. So what are your reflections on that?
Well, you mentioned earlier about transmitters like want to be in the limelight. I had a moment in my life, mainly in college, a little before probably, where I was, I had multiple bands. I had three at one point. I was the lead and I liked it a lot to the point where it came to a point where it scared me how much I liked it. Mm-hmm. It even alarmed me how much I felt like I could control a room. And how much I liked that, and it felt wrong.
Yeah.
And this was a while ago at this point. This is like 2006. And I backpedaled so hard and took, not behind the scenes completely, because I liked being around it, but I didn't want to be in the limelight anymore. I like platforming others. I'm not trying to convince you of anything. I'm actually just saying this is what it was. So I had a moment and I liked the moment almost too much. It was like a drug that I almost like felt like I was on the verge of overdosing on. And I was like, whoa. And that's when I backed off severely. And in fact, when I said like I started that church, I was the director of media and production, which meant everything behind the stage, like everything behind. I could have easily gone up on stage and I only went up twice, like the whole time I was there. And I kind of took a backseat role. I do it here in this role. All these people, like I push them in front and I stay back. And it all is because of that, whatever that was that happened to me 20 years ago. So I don't know what more context that is for you, but.
Well, it's exactly the inner conflict that I'm describing.
Okay.
Right. It's that impulse toward it. And then this shame about at the same time. Right. So, and it's, you know, it's exactly what happens with navigators, right? There's this part of them and, you know, you're also describing a, you know, an age in your life where, you know, number one, there's a whole lot of hormonal things going on in somebody in their late teens, early 20s, right? But there's also this identity finding, right? It's kind of a trying on of things, okay? And there is this part, you know, again, that's drawn to it. I mean, you know, I can use myself as an example. I do podcasts, I do, you know, training programs, I travel around the world giving, you know, talks. And I love it, man. I love being the center of attention, you know, and I feel disgusted by it at the same time, you know, and it's a thing that even at this point in my life, I still wrestle with is what is that appropriate, you know, zone of leveraging my public identity with, you know, not feeling like an egomaniac, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, what you're describing is exactly what I would expect. Yeah. You know, Seth Abrams, another great example of that. And so Seth Creekmore, right? I mean, they're both guys that, you know, have this thing around performing, right? That is unresolved for both of them, you know, of this, you know, draw toward and, you know, discomfort with at the same time. So it's classic navigator stuff.
So are they both in the navigator zone?
They're both navigators, yeah. Abram is a navigating nine, and Creek is a navigating four.
Four, got it. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. And the seven energy comes from me telling you I kind of went from thing to thing. Is that?
So it's multiple, right? I mean, that's, you know, the, you know, all these things are data points, right? So the thing to thing is a data point, right? Sure. But again, it's, you know, what, again, the literature on the sevens really, I find really, really frustrating is that, oh, they go from thing to thing because they don't finish things and they're irresponsible and all that sort of stuff. And no, that's not the case. They're hungry.
Which wouldn't be me at all. But,
right, yeah. Right. Okay. You know, look, I like to say, look, hey, you know, Richard Feynman, the physicist, was a seven. You know, Neil deGrasse Tyson is a seven. The Dalai Lama is a seven. You know, I mean, I think Desmond Tutu, is he still alive? I think he might have passed away recently, but I think he was a seven. You know, there are a tremendous number of sevens who have done huge, huge things in the world that require, you know, depth. And, you know, I mean, you don't get to be a Nobel Prize winning physicist, you know, by being shallow, superficial, and, you know, not finishing things. You don't end up the Dalai Lama, you know, by not having some depth and, you know, curiosity. Yeah. But, you know, the Dalai Lama is a seven. You know, I don't doubt it at all. I've been in his presence twice, you know, and just, you know, So again, I think that I find, particularly in the evangelical world of the Enneagram, or the Christian world of the Enneagram, sevens are very misidentified because they're described as superficial people that nobody would want to be. When in fact, what I find with sevens, I'm going to be, you know, look, all the types have their issues, you know, but I find, you know, sevens to be an extremely appealing personality style, right? I'm always actually drawn to sevens. You know, there's just something in me that finds myself moving toward them because of their, you know, look, they're not always happy. They're not always positive. They're not always optimistic. Okay. But they tend to be those things more than other people, right? Mm-hmm. And there's something very compelling about that. There's something that people are drawn to right? Of and there's also a almost complete lack of malice in sevens that people are drawn to, right? I mean, now you might have somebody that you hate because, you know, they killed your dog or whatever. I don't know. But, you know, but I find that most sevens are like, you know, well, look, why can't we just be happy and get along and, you know, move toward the positive things? What are we going to get caught up in this BS for, you know, and, you know, be angry at each other? Let's just, you know, look, man, let's just, you know, there's so much to be positive about. Let's move toward that. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, the other thing, I want to be clear. Again, nobody does anything all the time and everybody does everything some of the time. Okay. So I also find that with sevens, it's one of the personality types that's most prone to depression. Okay. That is most, can fall into traps of frustration because they can expect and want life to be, you know, a bowl of cherries and end up really disappointed when it's not. Okay. Or, you know, it can be something like, oh, I thought that party would be really great, but it was disappointing. Or I thought that pie would be wonderful, but it was a little disappointing. Now, that is most on display in the preserving and transmitting sevens. What I find with navigating sevens is that they're samplers, right? Life is kind of a banquet to them. And I'm going to taste a little of this, and I'm going to taste a little of that, and I'm going to give this a try and see how it feels. I'm going to give that a try. And again, it's got nothing to do with, you know, superficiality. It's just, hey, man, I'm going to taste that dish and see if I like it or not, right? And I don't have to eat the whole thing, right? You know, I just want to taste it and see. So,
I have an expression. I say, I'll try anything once.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so to get back to, you know, why I see you as a seven and what the data points were, yes, it was that kind of banquet approach to the world, but it's more just a, you know, what I see in you, Johnny, is just, it's a desire to see other people be happy. Okay. But it doesn't feel invasive to me. Right. Now look, I get what you're saying about giving people advice, all that sort of stuff. Right. But that's different. Okay. And what I see in twos is a tendency to, struggle with boundaries. Okay. And it's now again, you know, you might have boundary issues. I don't know, but it's not to the point where it's noticeable in me. And I don't see signs of significant boundary issues. In mm-hmm. fact, my, you know, my perspective of you is that, you want to be helpful to people. You want to be liked by people. You want to be connected to people. But, you know, I'm not going to lose sleep over this, you know, if it doesn't go the way I hoped, you know, or if I'm not, you know, if you're not responding to me and loving me and, you know, all these other sort of things. Of course, it might sometimes, right? I mean, but it's not going to be the thing, right? My guess with you, and I will ask you to think about what the people closest to you find most frustrating. Right.
About me?
Yeah, about you.
Okay.
Okay. And, you know, well, I get where I was going to go with this is kind of what you said about the Seths, right? Why aren't you more upset about this? Okay. Twos get really, really upset about things, right? Fours get really, really upset about things. Sevens are like, I wish that didn't happen. Yeah. Yeah, you know, that wasn't the right way for that person to handle it. But you know what? Let's move on, you know, kind of thing. That tends to be the attitude that sevens take. Hmm. So I'm going to ask you to consider this, okay? I'll send you a one-page description of the Navigating Seven. And I reserve the right to at some point say, hey, you know what? I was completely wrong. You know, you're actually this, that, or the other thing. Okay. Yeah. But honestly, during our conversation, I had a really hard time after the first 5 minutes not saying, dude, you're a seven. You know,
interesting. So,
yeah. And I tried to talk myself out of it, but I couldn't.
Yeah. So. No, I appreciate it. I was sending a Marco Polo to Seth Abram just before this. And I was like, yeah, I'm along for the ride. Let's do this. I was like, he's just going to pick like a random number that I haven't really considered. Like, because seven's not been on the radar ever.
Right.
It was a six. And I was like, no, I'm not really fear driven. Whatever. Two. And then I know your stance on like wings, but I was like, yeah, I have ones and three in me or whatever. And then like, you know, the eight and the four, like literally it's like the one number other than I guess nine that like I haven't really, and five, I guess. And so that's really comical to me, but it's given me a lot to like think about and chew on. Yeah, I had a hunch like you weren't going to affirm the two-ness. Like I was just like waiting, like what is it that I'm missing? I don't know why. But I guess because of things, you know, earlier. But yeah, I don't know. That's gives me a lot to think about.
Yeah. Look, if I thought you were a two, I would tell you, right? I mean,
yeah, no, of course.
No objection to that. And in fact, I would encourage you to you know, we did a podcast where we interviewed a guy who was a type two and talked about the vice, virtue, and fixation. That guy, no doubt, was a two, right? And I would encourage you to listen to it. I'll send you the link, but just to get a sense of what a two is like,
you know. I think we're going to know each other well enough by now. Like, I'm not trying to change your mind. I'm just going to bring up a few more things. Like, one is the flattery thing. I'm pretty good at it. And I got really good at it to the point where I try not to do it. Like, I don't like that I got good at it. And so I feel the compulsion to flatter someone in front of me because, again, what I thought I was doing is because I want them to like me. So who doesn't like somebody who flatters them? And so it was like a tool that I would use. And I was like, I don't like that I use that tool and that I can use it well. And so it is a thing I don't know if I would say suppressed. I would say I've tamed. Like I try just not to flatter as often. But again, I always feel like I did that to get them to like me. And then the other thing, I think twos, and I would like you to correct me if I'm wrong, are often accused of being really manipulative. And I'm often accused of that from my closest friends, that I'll do it in a way that's like kind, but I'll take a look at the situation and I will, you know, tweak a few levers, adjust a few knobs, because it'll produce the outcome that I want. And I guess I never put any of that with seven, I suppose. And I don't know what to make of that. But anyways, a few other thoughts.
Yeah. So let me respond to that. And again, I want to be careful about trying to justify, you know, my perspective.
Yeah.
I've been doing this long enough that if you said something that was truly anomalous to me, I would want to explore it, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, but there's a difference between wanting people to like me and needing to feel this deep connection with people.
Okay. Yeah.
So
I do feel the need for deep connection.
What's that?
I do feel the need of deep connection.
With whom?
Everyone around me. Okay. Well, no. Yeah, gosh, both. That's weird. I haven't had to think about that in a while. The older I'm getting, my circle is getting smaller, and I like that. But yes, also, if like a random person I had a meeting with here in an hour or whatever, I would want to try to connect with them.
Okay. And so what does connection mean to you in this, that situation?
Yeah. I mean, I used to frame it that I want them to like me.
Yeah.
So it was, but that was the language I was bringing to the table and adopting the two-ness. I would have said, I want to connect, because who doesn't like somebody who they connect with? So let's connect. That's just what I was doing.
Yeah.
What I think I was doing.
Yeah. The way I look at this is, what is the final answer of why, right? To the question of why. And for the seven, it's, I want people to like me, right? For the two, it's, I just need to be connected to people, right? There's no because this. I'll give an example. So I've got a friend who is a two, a very, very dear friend. And we were at an Enneagram conference in Helsinki. Okay. And so he goes out during the lunch break, and there's a young woman sitting on the sidewalk on a piece of cardboard. She's got a sign that says 5 minutes of eye contact for €5. Okay. And so she would have people sit there, pay her €5, and she would just sit and make eye contact with them, right? No exchange of words, you know, no nothing. And this guy just, he was just never happy, right? He just sat with this woman and made eye contact with her and got lost in her and didn't exchange any words. But it was just this feeling of connection that he just had a hunger for. Okay? And that was it. Okay. It had nothing to do with being like, what I find in sevens is they have this huge need to be liked by people. And in fact, we call it, you know, the contradiction of the seven, the acceptable face, right? I need to present myself in a way that's likable and acceptable to people so that they will like me. Because if I know somebody doesn't like me, if I know somebody's angry at me, I can't be happy, right?
Yeah. Or even a flipping of that. Like, I like to be liked, but I actually more so need to not be disliked.
Okay.
I think it's still the same thing, but do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I don't need everyone to like me. I just need them to really not dislike me as well.
Yeah. Yeah, the identity of the...
And I don't like admitting any of this, by the way.
What was that?
I don't like admitting any of this. Like,
well, look, I don't think there's anything to feel, you know, shame about. I mean, you know...
I'm sure there isn't, but it naturally, I'm just like, I don't like that people know that I even care about that at all, you know? Yeah.
Look, so the other piece of this I wanted to comment on, the manipulative thing. Okay. That's navigating stuff, right? Yeah. What the two does is kind of an emotional manipulation through feelings of guilt and, oh, if you really loved me, you would do this.
Right? Yeah, I wouldn't do it that way.
Right. What navigators are always doing is, you know, it's the image of the marionette strings from The Godfather, right? The Godfather poster. It's pulling the puppet strings, right? It's that, you know, tweaking of the dials, you know, pulling of the strings, manipulating things to get this outcome. That's what the navigating instinctual bias is all about, right? You know, anybody that knows me, you know, would tell you I'm a profoundly manipulative person. But, you know, my rule is that I manipulate things in ways that are good for the other person as well. Right. I mean,
it's usually what I say. Yeah.
What was that?
It's usually what I say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, so I see that more as that. So, you know, again, Johnny, I know that I'm, you know, kind of throwing a curveball at you.
Oh, I like it.
Yeah. And you know, and, you know, one of the reasons you probably never considered sevens seven is because the Enneagram literature just doesn't describe sevens accurately, right?
Yeah. I mean, the sevens in my life, I'm like, I'm not them. they're, you know, the ones that I've at least cornered, like I pegged as a seven, they're just like, what's next? What's next? What's next? What's next? And I'm like, geez, slow down. Like, enjoy the moment you're in. Yeah. And that's not me pushing back. I'm just saying, I sevens in my mind. I'm like, I'm not like them.
Yeah.
That's the transition. Okay. Yep.
Yeah. But go ahead. Finish your thought.
No, I don't know. I think that was all I was going to say. I did want to ask you, are you a navigating eight?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So, and look, navigators, you know, there's something about navigating as well. You know, the navigating instinctual bias is all about my identity within the group, right? And there's, you know, we call the contradiction or the dissonance, you know, connecting versus judging, right? So there's this part of me that wants to connect to people. So I have to show them things about myself that will make them like me, but not show them so much that they say, oh boy, I don't want any parts of that, right? So there's always this sort of measuring of what do I reveal? What don't I reveal? Right?
I absolutely do that. Yeah. But I also feel like, doesn't everyone, but maybe not. But that's how
not to the extent that navigators do.
I definitely do that. Yeah. I will show them who I think they will accept the quickest.
Yeah.
I don't try to be a version of me that's not true.
Yes.
But I will only show them the true parts of me that I think they'll accept.
Yes.
And then I'll show them other sides of me if they've earned it. Yeah. Like if like I can trust them a little bit more. And I'm like, all right, I'll tell you this, I guess. But I won't go straight there.
Yeah.
Very rarely, at least. Yeah.
Yeah. It's because it's all about acceptance within the group, right? Finding my place, knowing where I am, knowing where others are. And so I need to manage that. So it's very consistent. So, all right.
So, hey, Johnny, we're over our time. Sorry, I want to respect.
No worries at all. I've enjoyed our conversation, thanks. And I've enjoyed getting to know you a bit more. I'm going to send you a one-page description of the seven, and I am going to ask you to loop back with me after the holidays. Okay, and if I don't hear from you, I'll loop back with you, because again, I don't want to be, I want to be sure that. You know, we get a chance to answer any questions you have. And
that's very kind of you. Thank you for the time. I really, really appreciate it, Mario.
Pleasure. All right, Johnny. It was great talking. Have a great Christmas, okay?
See you. Merry Christmas.
All right, so that's the end of the first session. How'd you do? Did your hypothesis match Mario's, or was it completely different? Tell us about your experience. But make sure to tune in next week, because there's even more data, there's even more nuance, and I think we're all going to learn something from this experience. See you next week. Thanks for listening to the Awareness to Action Enneagram podcast. If you're interested in more information about Awareness to Action, their certification programs or events, feel free to reach out to us through the links in the show notes or by emailing info@awarenesstoaction.com.